Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and what a day for journalists. Spotlight wins the Best Picture Oscar at the Oscars last night. I didn't see that one coming. On this Leap Day, February 29th, we re-examine the leap of faith that drove U.S. policy in Libya, a leap that failed to take the country from the rule of dictator Muammar Gaddafi to a stable democracy. Instead, Libya has become the North African stronghold of ISIS. This piece of the Obama foreign policy has the clearest stamp of former Secretary of State, now candidate Hillary Clinton, on it. Here, Clinton celebrates those elections back in the summer of 2012.
After more than four decades of authoritarian rule, men and women from every corner of Libya are beginning to determine their own future, and it will be the will of the people, not the whim of a dictator.
Libya quickly unraveled, though, and later that year, a jihadist attack on the consulate in Benghazi killed the U.S. ambassador and other U.S. personnel. Fresh from an overwhelming political victory for Hillary Clinton in South Carolina over the weekend, we wondered how much of the Clinton record in Libya will be re-examined between now and Election Day. A series of articles co-authored by Scott Shane, national security reporter for our partner, The New York Times, looks at Clinton's involvement in Libya and the state of the country today. Shane is the author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott, is it fair to say that Secretary Clinton was the architect of this Libya policy?
I think it would be unfair to call her the architect of that policy in the sense that President Obama made all the ultimate decisions, but certainly her view that the U.S. should get involved in an international coalition to protect civilians from Gaddafi, from Colonel Gaddafi, the dictator, sort of tipped the balance. She convinced a skeptical President Obama to go against the advice of other senior advisors and, you know, join in the airstrikes that eventually would lead to Gaddafi's overthrow.
And there was even other intervention as well on the ground, although we haven't really understood what that was until now. Can you explain?
There were a number of things, but the rebel leaders say that CIA officers were on the ground assisting them, providing information on Gaddafi's troop movements and that kind of thing. And the U.S. was covertly supplying arms to the rebels as well.
And is it the case that Hillary Clinton pushed very strongly for a full-scale secret mission to have special ops on the ground?
I mean, it's certainly our understanding from talking to many officials in different parts of the government that she, you know, once she made a decision that this was a cause she wanted to support, she was, very assertive in trying to make sure the rebels won and, that the U.S. effort was successful.
There's a great quote in one of your stories, and it's attributed to an American diplomat who says, "Once the endorphins of revolution faded, then it became clear that Libya's new leaders weren't really able to unite the country." Where were these endorphins? Were they in American officials' brains or were they in Libyan brains?
I think the answer is both. I mean, in some ways, in that respect, Libya is emblematic of the entire Arab Spring, where folks will remember how much optimism there was. You had young people in, you know, capital after capital taking to the streets, not calling for jihad, but calling for democracy. And it was a very optimistic time. Guys like Gaddafi, with whom we had made an accommodation, but who everyone recognized as a megalomaniac and a not a good guy, seemed to be on the way out. And there was a lot of enthusiasm both on the Libyan side and on the American side, and certainly on the part of the French and the British as well.
And you have the country trying to revert to its pre-Ottoman era borders, separated into Benghazi and Tripoli. You see some of the same sorts of things going on in Syria. Do you think there's a parallel in Syria, or is Libya a special case?
The ironic thing about Libya is it's a country of 6 million people. It's got lots of oil, and therefore people thought it could sort of pay for it to rebuild without Western help after the toppling of Gaddafi. And there's no Sunni-Shia split. So if there were ever, a lot of people, American experts really thought that if there was a, country where this might not be such a rocky process, Libya would be it. Syria is much larger, much more complicated, in a very, complex neighborhood in the middle of the Middle East. And, there are certainly some parallels, but in many ways, Syria is much more difficult, I think, than Libya.
In the statements of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and now candidate Hillary Clinton, do you see a vision of a foreign policy that would deal with the current problems in Libya?
Well, in her defense, we were told that she did want to do more. Part of this was we would overthrow Gaddafi, and then I think President Obama in particular thought the Europeans, for whom this was sort of their neighborhood and who had been the sort of leading the charge against Gaddafi in the first place, that they would take over and help the Libyans rebuild. As it turned out, the French and British sort of got distracted, and the U.S. didn't offer a whole lot of help or was not able to offer any effective help. And the Libyans themselves were sort of riding a wave of nationalism and telling outsiders, we got this, we don't need your help. In many of these kinds of situations, you have a an outside peacekeeping force to provide stability and security while the country gets its act together. That didn't happen. And so as a result, things fell apart. The consequences have been pretty dire, not just for Libyans, but also for much of the rest of the world, in the sense that there's been a huge flow of weapons out of Libya, where Gaddafi had stashed millions and millions of weapons over the years, into neighboring countries and as far away as Sinai and Nigeria. So those have fueled terrorist groups and conflicts in other places. A huge human smuggling trade emerged in the chaos, which fed into the refugee crisis, with people, as listeners will remember, passing through Libya, getting into boats and getting out on the Mediterranean, where many of them drowned. And within Libya, of course, there's been this terrible civil war, and that has given rise to havens for militant groups, notably ISIS. And ISIS now has its largest sort of outpost outside of Syria and Iraq on the Libyan coast.
Scott Shane is national security reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He's the author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And now the story of a political journey by one voter that may be repeated in different ways between now and November. But just a reminder, tomorrow is Super Tuesday, where 865 delegates hang in the balance for Democrats, 661 for Republicans. There are 116 delegates up for grabs in Massachusetts on the Democratic side, 42 delegates on the Republican side, and a lot of power rests with so-called unenrolled voters in that state, people who aren't registered with a particular party but are still free to cast a vote on Super Tuesday. Massachusetts is a must-win for Senator Bernie Sanders, who usually does well with white Northeastern liberals. But Hillary Clinton isn't making it easy for him. The two candidates are virtually neck and neck in the polls. And here's the journey. One millennial Democratic voter is with us now who used to be on the fence. Tori Knobloch, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're 26 years old, right?
Yes, I am.
A Massachusetts Democrat.
Correct.
And you've been on a journey. From Planet Sanders to Planet Clinton. Can you explain how that worked out?
Sure. Well, back when the election was just kicking off, I was very drawn to Bernie because His policies really hit on a lot of the day-to-day issues that are important for millennials, such as college debt and the poor job market for millennials, as well as the racial injustice that we're seeing in prison reform and economic reform and marijuana legislation. Those are all issues that are important to people my age and affect our day-to-day lives. And so I was very drawn to Bernie in the beginning, and I had this, what I can only describe as an ick factor about Hillary Clinton. I just looked at her, and I didn't like her. And as I thought more and more about that, I couldn't place why I didn't like her. And sure, like, I disagreed with some of her past policies, and I think some of the things that she says I don't agree with, but I think that she ultimately is the smartest person in the room, and what was holding me back was sort of a latent misogyny within myself that she had to be likable or she had to be cool. She's trying so hard to be cool with the Snapchatting and everything, and that sort of turned me off. But ultimately,
Wait a second. So you had to confront your own self-hatred?
Well, it's not my own self-hatred. I think that simply by existing in our society, we internalize a lot of sexist media. And if you look at any mainstream picture that is at the top of any Hillary article, you know, she's kind of got crazy eyes. They call her shrill. They talk about what she's wearing, what her hair is like, often as much as they're talking about the issues. And I think I was responding to that. I was like, wow, yeah, no, she does look like she's kind of, you know, got that crazy look in her eyes. But I think it's really a photo editing issue.
Do you think that's going to go away as we get into a one-on-one campaign? I mean, God knows when that will be, but you know what I'm saying.
Right. Well, I think it's going to be interesting after the results of tomorrow. I think that will tell us whether or not we're in for a long haul in this primary or if we're going to be moving on to a general election quickly. And it's hard to say exactly if we end up in a Hillary-Trump situation, exactly how that would play out, both in the debates and in the national media. I think I'm personally very interested to see how that would go.
There's also the issue question. I mean, Hillary makes the point, this is her message, I'm a progressive who can get things done. Bernie Sanders is a kind of a fringe senator who's a socialist, who is certainly very credible and a great candidate, but still is not going to be able to get things done the way Hillary has a track record of getting things done. Does that resonate with you at all?
It does. And I think reading over both of their platforms, I find I was just looking at their racial justice pages on their website yesterday, and Bernie's is much longer, and it breaks it down into all sorts of, you know, small details that need to be resolved. So reforming police culture is one of the things he lists on his racial justice thing. And that's great. We do need to reform police culture. Like, that's an incredibly complicated issue. There's no concrete resolution that I've heard from him on small issues like that. Whereas Hillary's page is shorter, but it's much more in depth in terms of what the concrete policies that she wants to set up to best fight racial injustice in this country. And I think that more and more millennials are sort of seeing that she has real plans in place. And while they love Bernie's message, they also want to see things get done.
So, Tori, it's Hillary. You're not moving anymore, right?
Not moving anymore. I already voted absentee.
All right. Tori Knoblauch is a 26-year-old Massachusetts Democrat. Thanks so much, Tori.
Thank you so much for having me.
So here are the rules, folks. Do not say the N-word if you are white or the B-word if you are male. Those are just two rules in the Manual of Political Correctness. The official manual, of course, doesn't exist, but all the rules infuriate Donald Trump, apparently, and his supporters seem to love it.
I think he's leading because he says what he thinks. And so I think a lot of people appreciate his candor and, well, his political incorrectness. Okay. So he really likes to just tell it like it is. And I think a lot of people, right or wrong, believe in what he says.
That's Lonnie Madding, a Donald Trump supporter, speaking to a reporter outside a Trump rally in Manassas, Virginia. This is a different kind of political correctness from the paranoid conspiracy theory version of PC concocted by ideologues like Rush Limbaugh, who like to talk about feminazis and liberal stormtroopers. This is a kinder, gentler, subtler, but still maddening political correctness. President George H.W. Bush spoke against it back in 1991.
The notion of political correctness has ignited controversy across the land. And although the movement arises from the laudable desire to sweep away the debris of racism and sexism and hatred, it replaces old prejudice with new ones. It declares certain topics off limits. What began as a crusade for civility has soured into a cause of conflict and even censorship.
Arun Venugopal is a reporter for WNYC's Micropolis. Arun, what do you think is going on here? When the language is changing, it's a sign of something subtler and deeper happening.
Well, I think this what you're really talking about is sort of power being contested by power. And we're talking about certain norms of speech and behavior and politics that, you know, more conservative, so to speak, that are being challenged from the left. And I think that as there's been a growing sort of challenge to this, it's been going on for a while now, but this is what you're seeing the response on the right, is that people are saying, no, you can't tell me what to do. You can't tell me how to talk. And I think this is when things get kind of interesting.
Is this a healthy sign that the democracy is trying to come to a consensus? Or is it the dictatorial impulses of some power elite?
You know, I think that there are a lot of people who feel policed. It's not just, your stereotypical old white conservative guy who feels like, you know, why can't I just say what I want to say or whatever. There's a lot of people who feel like, oh my gosh, I have no idea what the right word is these days, you know. And language changes so fast, you know. I mean, it's coming out of social media and culture in directions that you can't keep, like, you know, you can't really stay on top of what's happening. There is a poll recently and saying that it's not just, you know, these old white conservative men that I was referring to. It's Democrats, it's women, it's minorities. A lot of people think that political correctness is kind of an issue. That said, you know, I mean, there are certain words we can all easily agree on are offensive and that should have been discarded a long time ago. So I think that it's really just like, this is how democracy works. Is it healthy? I don't know. Is America a healthy democracy? I'm not sure a lot of us would agree with that right now.
Yeah, that's a bad moment to be asking that question. But 68% of all Americans do think PC is a big problem. I mean, that's the poll that you're talking about there. So, I mean, clearly people have some anxiety about this, but it is a sign that assumptions are being tested.
On any given day, I am worried when I put something out there, even if it's to my so-called friends on social media. I'm kind of worried somebody's going to say, Arun, that's really offensive. You know, why'd you say that? You know, like, what kind of person are you? You know, you're going to be judged in some manner. And I think social media does keep us anxious in general. But I think this language thing is some way in which people are being held accountable, sometimes for good reasons and sometimes for completely ridiculous reasons.
What do you think politically is going to be the result of Donald Trump's candor and, you know, this discussion that seems to be injected now into the 2016 campaign?
I think that this is what we're really seeing in many different ways. It's the reflection of this rapidly changing demographic. You have people, you know, people of color, you know, Hispanics, African Americans, immigrant populations, different ethnicities. There is sort of a critical mass that has sort of been formed in the last so many years. And I think that is sort of challenging a more traditional view of America. You know, and when people say, let's make America great again, I think that sort of makes other people scratch their heads. Like, great again? Like when? What are you talking about? What
and is which that America?
Exactly. Yeah. Which America? It's a very sort of like old mythic sense of America that probably never existed. And to the extent that we think it existed, it's kind of problematic.
But it does seem as though the political debate is really disconnected from the actual sensitive social debate that goes on about identity and race right now.
These terms like white privilege, which didn't really – nobody used words like this even a couple years ago. And now people use it all the time. It's a hashtag. I think that even terms like privilege, you know, they very quickly get kind of co-opted or overused or whatever it is. But the fact is, in actual interaction, people do realize, like, yeah, there is a problem when this huge portion of the black male population is essentially invisible. It's imprisoned, you know, when poverty rates are super high, when extraordinary ratio in terms of the number of, say, African-Americans who are likely to be shot in a police encounter versus people who are not black. These realities are sort of hard to deny, you know. When it gets into language, I think in some ways it does reflect this reality. But at the same time, people don't like to be told how to talk. At the same time, they kind of do obey. You know, the N-word, nobody uses anymore.
That's right.
And there are other words as well that are pretty simple. We know that's a bad word. There's so much other language, though. I think it's kind of like, oh, who are you to tell me? You know, I mean, it's not such a bad word. And I'm not a bad guy. You know, why do you think I am a bad guy? And I think that sense of like, who is the authority person here? Who is the authority figure? Who should decide? nobody can agree on that.
Policing and political correctness, a subject taken up by Arun Venugopal, reporter and host of Micropolis, WNYC's ongoing examination of race, sexuality, and identity. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
A milestone for a five-year-old quagmire?
If implemented, and that's a significant if, this cessation could reduce the violence and get more food and aid to Syrians who are suffering and desperately need it. It could save lives. Potentially, it could also lead to negotiations on a political settlement to end the civil war so that everybody can focus their attention on destroying ISIL.
President Obama announcing the first successfully negotiated truce in the Syrian civil war, set to begin over the weekend and last for 2 weeks. Stephen Kinzer, currently a columnist at the Boston Globe and a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Stephen, the humanitarian needs are overwhelming in Syria. A political process is non-existent. Can these antagonists do much more than reload over the next few days?
I think that is a possibility, yes, that they could do something more. We are seeing something different now, which is an agreement among some of the major players in this conflict to talk to each other. That's a big step forward. We had a chance to do this 4 years ago. That's one of the saddest things about watching this process unfold today. In 2012, Kofi Annan, at the direction of his UN Secretary General's successor, came up with a peace plan for Syria. It involved everybody sitting down at the table as a first step, and the United States refused to go along with that. We went along instead with the urgings of our friends in Israel and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and said we wouldn't negotiate with anyone who didn't already say Assad must go before the negotiations even began. So that meant neither Assad's government nor Iran, which was already a big player, could participate in the negotiations. And as a result of that, Kofi Annan realized there couldn't be any negotiations. That message, incidentally, was delivered on behalf of the United States by Secretary of State Clinton. So we had a chance in 2012 to have a deal that would be something like what we have now. What's happened is we've tiptoed back away from our feeling that we would never negotiate with people on the other side. And we're starting to realize that to end a war, you need to have all the factions to the war around the table, otherwise an agreement isn't going to work.
The president pointedly says that everyone will soon be able to focus their attention on destroying ISIL. I suspect that that means there will be no negotiations with ISIL. And I'm wondering if militarily we've already passed the point where they are players and they need to be reckoned with in ways other than just bombing them.
I don't think we're at a point yet where you'll be able to get representatives of those groups, ISIS and the Nusra Front, to the table. And that may not be necessary. We have a big problem before we get there. And that is that none of our partners in this war share our goal. Our goal, as you just heard President Obama say, is to destroy ISIS. But none of our partners consider that their main goal. It's not the main goal of Saudi Arabia, from which ISIS gets a great deal of its support. It's not a main goal of Turkey, which is more aimed at the Assad government and at destroying the Kurds. We are the only factor in that war other than the Assad government and Russia and Iran that wants to destroy ISIS as a principal goal.
What does this mean for Assad, do you think?
I think it holds out the possibility that there could be some permanence to his regime over at least the medium term. And I think that's actually a good thing. I don't see any way that a large part of Syria is going to be stabilized for any period of time unless it's under the rule of the Assad government.
Stephen Kinzer is a columnist at the Boston Globe and a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Always great to talk to you, Stephen.
Thank you.
30 years after the AIDS crisis in the United States, it's hard to generate any urgency about a disease we've been told is survivable with the right drug management regimen. But in the Deep South, it's as though the activism and protests of the 1980s and 90s didn't happen. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says right now African Americans have the most severe burden of HIV of all racial ethnic groups in the United States. The reasons are cultural, as well as the old story of allowing the medical infrastructure in a high-risk community to wither. June Cross is a documentary television and film producer. Her film, Wilhelmina's War, tells of one grandmother's determination to fight for the preservation of her family and for the protection of the health of those around her.
I certainly thought going in that AIDS was something that was a problem in Africa that we'd handled in the United States. And then I discovered that people were dying of AIDS in South Carolina, and that's what made me go there. And I discovered that black women were contracting infections at way higher rates than white women or Latino women. And I picked up a magazine, and there was an article written by a 13-year-old girl about what it was like to have been born HIV positive and live in a town of 1,500 people, knowing nobody else who was living with HIV. And so we went down to meet them, and we met Wilhelmina and Deschelle. And, you know, once we met, Wilhelmina was just a force of nature. She was, when we met her, 62. She was absolutely shameless.
My name is Wilhelmina Dixon. First, I'd like to thank the Reverend for having us here. I don't know how to put it in all them fine words like she do, but I got God here in my heart. And I came this morning to ask you all to listen at me.
So it was that sort of level of her openness in the face of sort of the overwhelming shame and stigma that seemed to surround HIV infection in that area of South Carolina that made me go there.
One of the great things about this film is how you get to hear people in conversations almost thinking out loud as to why this is happening to them. There's a great scene in a barbershop. How did you get those scenes?
We ran into these two great activists, Vivian Clark Armstead and Tony Sells. And so they took us to that barbershop, and the men were sort of dutifully saying all the right things. You know, yes, we know we're supposed to use condoms, blah, 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 blah. I had the feeling that they weren't being real with us. And so we all left, and we left my cameraman in there. And he said, just stay in there for a couple hours and keep this conversation going and let's see what happens.
How is it just the fact that black people are the ones with it the most? I think it was man-made in the lab to control the population. You can't just say black people out here having sex more than any other race.
Okay, Damon, let me ask you something. I'm listening. When last time you used a condom?
I don't use no condom.
You also get this feeling here, and it's very powerful, that the history of African Americans does not help here. There's a moment, and it goes by very, very quickly. And I think it's Vivian Clark Armstead who gives a speech in a church where she says, if you're waiting for the cavalry, they're not coming.
This state right now is investing very little in the saving the lives of African Americans impacted by HIV/AIDS. And so if you're waiting on the cavalry to come, if you're waiting on somebody else to come and save us, if you think help's coming, just think about Katrina. They ain't coming.
I think there's an element of that that's very true. I had finished shooting, and I stumbled across a Washington Post headline from 1994. The CDC had discovered that when men presented to hospitals in South Carolina with the pneumonia that is usually the first signifier that you have the AIDS virus, white men were told that they had AIDS and given treatment. Black men were treated for the pneumonia and sent home. So this tells us that the disease was allowed to take root in African-American communities in ways that it wasn't in the white community.
Does the church help or hinder this?
There are churches that are helping, but in the rural areas, churches not willing to talk about it yet. There was a pastor that we talked to that I originally met in Charleston, who I said, would you go back with me to the – he had been in a rural church, and he moved to Charleston in part because he wanted to do more HIV outreach. And I said, will you come back to us to that church and do a sermon there? And he was like, no. People are afraid that the stigma that attaches to drug addicts and gays – will come into the church if they start talking about AIDS from the pulpit.
What's Wilhelmina's experience in dealing with the church, both in its tolerance and intolerance of this issue?
Wilhelmina lives down the street from a church that wouldn't let her talk about it there. Since she's made contact with some of the activists that live in Columbia, she's been able to go to other churches and has somewhat become more sort of an ambassador.
I was going here and there. They wouldn't even let me talk about it in Summer Grove Baptist Church. That was my church. So I'm just asking everybody if we could come together, do some workshops, and I just ask y'all and I thank y'all.
It's a mixed experience. And I think the smaller the church and the more isolated, those are the areas where it's very difficult for some reason.
What's the story of Shamala?
Wilhelmina had a daughter, Toni, who died of AIDS, and we went to her daughter's funeral. And then at the funeral, we saw this young woman sitting over in a wheelchair, and I thought she had MS or something, and I walked over to say hello. And she said, no, I have it too. They call it the thing. I have that thing too. She'd been living with the virus for 15 years, and she had a very hard time. She couldn't get the doctors to work with her on getting the right cocktail. So in those days, they were still doing a variety of medications, and she was having very bad side effects. She finally decided that her quality of life was so bad that she'd prefer to just go off the medications and let the virus take its course than continue to live like that.
Is Wilhelmina's war a losing battle?
I don't believe it's hopeless. And I think the more that we can bring awareness to the rest of the country and get those who are active in the North engaged more with people in the South instead of a house-divided fight, I don't think it's hopeless.
June Cross, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
June Cross is a documentary film and television producer. Her film, Wilhelmina's War, airs tonight on PBS's Independent Lens. Donald Trump says America is too politically correct. Livermore, California says political correctness has somehow taken on a negative connotation, when in reality, it is simply a form of courtesy. Why would you intentionally offend? That said, there can be a level of sensitivity that constrains discourse and particularly humor. The challenge is in finding the balance.
This is Rupa Moswani. I'm calling from Westfield, New Jersey. For me, it's never really an issue of language, but rather a subject. I only discuss politics or religion or foreign policy with certain people. I don't agree with doing it, but I follow the rules. I've never understood the maxim of not discussing religion or politics in polite company. I think it results in a downgrading of the public discourse.
Tell us your thoughts, PC or not. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Familiar faces everywhere, and not all of them real presidents.
I suppose I should be pleased that I'm finally going to be hung in our nation's attic. Of course, if they knew what was in my basement, they wouldn't hang me so close to Lincoln. I'd end up next to Booth instead.
Is that the voice of President Francis Underwood? One of the things we could learn in the premiere this week of the fourth season of Netflix's House of Cards is how much it costs to rent the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery to shoot a scene. The series kicks off with the unveiling of a 6x6-foot portrait of the show's lead character, President Francis Underwood, played by Kevin Spacey, painted by the British portrait artist Jonathan Yeo. Yeo says there were a lot of things driving this collision between reality and art. It was a chance, he says, to have an image capable of making an artistic statement on many levels at once.
That's the nub of it, really. I try to go and see the performance itself. So if it's a play, obviously, that you see it live. I went to see him on set when he was actually recording some of it. I'd watched the finished performance, and when he came to sit for me, he was already filming the next series, so he was back in character a bit.
Because in a way, as an artist, you're trying to get into the depth of the character, but here you're trying to get into the depth of the surface.
That's exactly the dilemma. So take my premise had always been that your face tells you your whole story, you know, whether it's contradicting what someone's saying, or it's just communicating in a non-verbal way, which we all do, and the signals we read in a non-verbal way, that we communicate, it's a big part of the way we communicate. And obviously, as a portrait painter, you're suggesting that either those expressions or the lines that have been etched on your face from years of behavior or reacting in a certain way are the inner truth about you. And therefore, an actor is trying to deceive you. Yeah, he's trying to imply that he's not the person he really is, but he's someone else. And he's using his face in large part to do that. And so almost by definition, the better they're doing their job, the harder it is for me as a portrait painter to do mine.
You make a great case. But I do have to say, in this election, the 2016 election, I maybe could do without another reminder of how blurred the lines of entertainment and politics are. It's hurting me, Jonathan. It's really hurting me.
I don't think it's as much fun for either of us, for me and for Kevin either, as we thought at the start. I think we were aware that the timing of this would coincide with the beginning of the campaign. And these campaigns, especially in America, are always of great interest to not just, I mean, obviously locally, but to the rest of the world too. I don't think any of us really imagined at that stage, even when there was a thought that you might have a character like Donald Trump involved, that we'd already be at the stage where it looked like a very real possibility that he was going to be absolutely central to the whole campaign.
It is not the first actor to hang in the presidential portrait gallery. That would be Ronald Reagan.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Don't have that.
So. Absolutely. And, you know, and in our country, we haven't had people who've been actual professional actors as prime ministers, but we've certainly had people who seem to be very good at acting in retrospect.
And another way that we're ahead of you and we're trying. It actually makes me feel worse that you and Spacey didn't on your own concoct the whole Trump thing. And it just happened randomly. Well, you said we didn't come up with it, but I actually would have felt better if you'd said we did come up with it.
I didn't, but I wouldn't put anything past Kevin's brilliant, right. Evil genius mind.
Why do people in the UK like him?
I think everyone likes him. I don't think it's just in the UK. I think he also has a brilliant. I mean, in some ways, the fact that he came to the UK and did Shakespeare, probably better than anyone had done it for years. And I think sometimes it takes an outsider to do something very brilliantly, which you think is your own, to take over a theatre, which we thought was, one of our great national treasures, and make it much more successful and much better and remind people why it's good. I think it sometimes in any country takes an outsider, sometimes come in and shine a spotlight on something for you to really understand it, what's unique about it.
Did you know the line that he says in the scene where it hangs? Maybe someone will walk by and think I'm going to kick them in the face. Did you know that line was in the script?
I didn't know it was in the script, but it's something which we had. He's got a lovely attention to detail, and he was interested in how I was going to do it. He wasn't trying to tell me how to do it, but he was fascinated by why I'd done everything for what reason. And there is that ambiguity. The foot does. I wanted the foot to feel like it's coming out at you. And I think that's one of the successful things about the picture. And you are closer to the foot because of the size of the painting than you are to the head. And therefore, I think you get a sense that this person is not to be trusted.
Yeah.
And makes you step back a little bit further from it than you might another painting.
Well, it's a part of the blurring. The painting suggests the line, whether it was in the script or not.
Well, that's the idea. And I think that, without, again, overstating it, there was such an obvious bit of fun to be had on so many levels because of this particular character and the context of where it's going to hang and the parallels between his job, my job, the Smithsonian's job against the backdrop of this election, which was just a lovely coming together. And it's possibly a one-off opportunity to demonstrate all these things in one painting.
Finally, talking about the Smithsonian's job for a moment, there are people who listen to this conversation and go, oh, the National Portrait Gallery, I mean, they might even not make the top 10 list of things to visit when you're in Washington. I mean, they don't have the rockets like the Air and Space Museum. They don't have, the Capitol or the big Lincoln Memorial. They aren't on any of the money. Some of the presidents are, but the Portrait Gallery, you got to kind of dig to figure out that that's there. This is just their way of marketing themselves. So,
by putting a picture up, it is their job to put paintings up. But I think,
Are they sullying their mission by having you do this?
Personally, I'd absolutely argue the opposite. And I think that the way people – I think people didn't get it. If people came away confused, then that would be a plausible argument. But I don't think – I think we all realized that was unlikely to be the case. And, you say it's off the map. It is one of the best galleries of its kind in the world, if not the best. It's many times bigger than the one in London. Mm. And I think that sometimes it just takes something like this where – we were lucky to get as much interest in it as we have. I've been blown away by how much people have connected with this painting. But also, apparently, people now going to the gallery who haven't been there for a long time and realizing what an amazing collection they have. And I think that it's, you need imaginative people running these galleries just to sort of like make them, to remind people that they're there. It's a great national institution and people should go there and enjoy it more.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Yeo's portrait of President Francis Underwood now hangs in the Smithsonian. And the new series of House of Cards starts later this week on Netflix. And here's something to take with you today. I said it was a good day for journalists and journalism because Spotlight won Best Picture last night at the Oscars. It's the story of the tragic but successful investigation by some Boston reporters whose very not-star faces you might have spotted on the Oscar red carpet last night, reporters Michael Resendez and Sasha Pfeiffer, played by Mark Ruffalo and Rachel McAdams in the film. Last year, when the real reporters talked to us, Sasha said she was still amazed their story was Hollywood material.
We really wondered when we first heard they wanted to make a movie, how do you make an interesting movie about our jobs, which are largely phone calls, document review, and data entry?
Well, all that phone calling and document reviewing, no special effects required, did the trick.
But they made it pretty engrossing and kept it authentic. I mean, I think that one of the hardest things about this project was dealing with people who decades later were still locked in time by a trauma that had happened years earlier, decades earlier. But that becomes angering, and anger becomes motivational. And I think that's the effect it had on all of us.
Did the movie take you back to those moments and allow you to relive them? Or is this a little bit of a, you know, Hollywoodization?
No, I don't think it's a Hollywoodization at all. I think the movie captures to a remarkable degree the substance and the spirit of what we did. You know, it wasn't always pleasant to be rocketed back in time to 2001. I think for all of us, it was tough. Also, we worked incredibly hard. I mean, we were working 7 days a week. I mean, this was a difficult part of our lives, I think. And
that intense work is why you no longer look like Mark Ruffalo.
That's right. It takes its toll.
Well, you're closer to Rachel McAdams. Good day for journalism and the movies. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.